mixed behind all this for us in Sweden is the fact that we are we used to be number one when it came to exporting music with ABBA, and now we're number one when it comes to exporting violent criminals. And we are outside of Mexico, we have the largest amount of bombings and grenade violence in a peacetime country. So you can see that many have realized we are not that country that we used to be. And if we don't do anything about it now, it might be too late.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Eva Arpi. Eva, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Very good to be with you.
It's great to have you on. It's always good to chat with you. We've had a few chats over the years, and I feel like there is an awful lot for us to talk about at the moment. You, for listeners who don't know, you are a prominent writer in Sweden. You're a Swedish blogger, columnist, Substacker, bit of a troublemaker, I would say, bit controversial every now and then, and I think always talking sense on issues to do with Sweden and Europe more broadly. So it's good to have you on at this time in particular. And I want to kick off by asking you about the fallout from the terror attack that Sweden has just recently suffered. So it took place in Brussels, not in Sweden, but it was an attack on a bunch of Swedish football fans. Two were killed, one was injured, carried out by a Tunisian man who we now discover escaped from prison in Tunisia, claims to be associated with the Islamic State. A horrible terrorist attack on Swedish citizens. I believe it's causing shockwaves in Sweden. I wanted to ask you what the response has been in Sweden, what the atmosphere is like. Is it a big issue there? Are people worried now about their own safety?
Well, first off, I'm labeled a troublemaker, but I find myself sort of innocent in the sense that it's very easy to be a troublemaker in Sweden. You just have to not agree with like the current consensus, then you're a troublemaker. So it's a very, I am a troublemaker, but I'm a very mild troublemaker if it would have been in any other context. But the strange thing with the terrorist attack in Brussels is that it hasn't made that much of a splash, so to speak, in Swedish debate, because it's been so overshadowed by the events taking place in Israel and Gaza and the huge demonstrations we have had in Sweden and ongoing demonstrations in support of Gaza. And then some strange, we've had like an ongoing propaganda campaign against Sweden that in Muslim countries that is being, it's like a information warfare that they are accusing Swedish government agencies to kidnap Muslim children in an attempt to take away their identity and in an Islamophobic motive. So during these demonstrations, there's been calls for kill all the Jews, basically, and also, how dare you accuse Hamas of kidnapping 20 kids when you, Swedish government, are kidnapping thousands of Muslims? And this is on Sergels Torg in the middle of Stockholm, thousands of people are turning up. So for a lot of us, the terrorist attack is just sort of mixed in with it, with all this. The Allahu Akbar that was like, that he shouted when he killed two Swedes and injured a third, sort of like just seamlessly, it was from the 7th of October attacks when, of course, the massacre perpetrated by Hamas, they were also screaming Allahu Akbar. So it's been hard to really sort things out. What are we talking about? Because it sort of blends together.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with that. And I really want to ask you about Swedish people's response to the calamity in Israel, the Hamas pogrom against Israelis, because I've seen some disturbing scenes from Sweden in relation to that. But just on the terrorism in Brussels, I think you're right. It's very easy for these things to kind of blur into each other. Or one thing that I've noticed with terrorist attacks in the UK And we've had many over the years, very, very serious ones, like the Manchester Arena bombing, which killed 21, mainly young people, an attack in London Bridge, an attack in other parts of London where, you know, significant numbers of people have been killed. Amnesia kicks in very quickly, and we're almost encouraged to forget about these attacks. And I remember not long ago, it was the fifth anniversary of the Brussels bombing, in which I think 35 people were killed. I think it was 5 years ago. And even I had forgotten about that, because there is this culture of amnesia around terrorism. Do you think that's something that's kicked in already in Sweden in relation to the attack in Brussels? Because sometimes it's important to untangle how people respond to events, but sometimes it's important to untangle why people are not responding to events, why there's a silence or a lack or an absence where you might expect there to be some kind of discussion or some kind of reflection. So has it just been a kind of silence, a forgetting, a desire to move on as quickly as possible from that?
Yeah, I actually think you make a great point of not only the amnesia, but the encouraging of that amnesia. It's a sort of encouraged to move on. And I think it was you who wrote a great piece a few years back when the ludicrous encouraging English and British people to don't look back in anger after the Manchester bombing. And it's still, like, when I think about it, it still makes me angry. I look back in anger. I'm not British, but it makes me angry to even suggest that you should not look back in anger when people are being murdered. And so that was actually one of the first responses from our prime minister and our ex-prime minister, who's Magdalena Andersson, who's the leader of the Social Democratic Party, which is by far now in the polls the largest party. And she said that we should basically manage how we, like, lower the voices, have a nicer tone. And our prime minister, Ulf Kristersson, who's the leader of the moderate party, the right-wing party, he said that just because it's legal doesn't mean that it's suitable or it's good to do it. So, and that's one of the things he's been echoing since the burning of the Quran made by an Iraqi citizen. And it seems like it's a reflex. Like, now it's not the time to feel anger. And I feel it's the total opposite. And I think that this is something, even when the more might be fitting that we are focusing on the developments in Israel, but we should return to this because Swedes are being targeted for being Swedes. And you have people that are very hostile to Sweden, living in Sweden. And so we should return to it. And the tone police they must be confronted, because the natural response is to be angry and to look for, like, is this something that is condoned in wider circles? Who are condemning the attacks? And what's often the case is during these things is that very few demonstrations were held by Muslims or mosques or Muslim organizations condemning the terrorist attack in Brussels against the Swedes. And the same can be said for the Hamas massacre. It's been the total opposite. The first responses to the Hamas massacre was basically good on the Palestinians. When it came to the attack against the Swedes, there is sort of a sense that you get from these people that what goes around comes around. It's not exactly that you condone it or you think it's great, but it's, well, what did you expect? I might not be my calmest self at the moment, and since the 7th October and the terrorist attack, and I would say that people are... There's a shift a little bit in the public sentiment when it comes to these issues, I hope. And people are starting to realize, like, this is not how we can't live like this.
Yeah. I think what you refer to as tone policing is a very good way to describe it. And we see that all the time in the UK after the terrorist attacks we've had. It's like, you know, you can't, they do want you to respond, but they want you to respond in a very passive way. They want you to respond in a regretful way, you know, lay some flowers, maybe put up an image on your social media page for a day or two. But then, you know, as you say, the great Oasis song was martial to the cause of saying, don't look back in anger. So those are the emotions you can't feel. You can't feel angry. You can't feel infuriated. You certainly can't feel questioning of how this can happen in our society. As you say, who might support it? What communities are these ideas taking hold in? You can't ask those questions. And the accusation that is used against people who express the wrong emotions in response to terrorism, who get angry rather than just sad, is that they are going to whip up Islamophobia. And one of the most striking things I've seen in Europe, across Europe over the past 10 years, has been this instant Pavlovian response, which says, you know, as soon as a bomb goes off, you will see commentators saying, listen, calm down, everyone, otherwise there'll be Islamophobia. It's like, as soon as a radical Islamist kills people, their first thought is, oh no, what about the Muslims? You know, are they going to be okay? Which is a very strange response when you think about it. Do you have a similar dynamic in Sweden? Is there, what's the discussion on Islamophobia like in Sweden?
It's basically, it's very, very similar. And it's similar. Sometimes you think that you're a unique country as a Swede or something, but then you look at how the discussions are taking place in other countries. And of course, there are differences, but there are a lot of similarities. And this immediate response of thinking about how are the Muslims doing when there is an Islamist attack. Sometimes it's even before it was known that it was Anders Behring Breivik who committed the terrorist attack in Norway. People were twittering like, now remember, all Islamists are Muslim, but not all Muslims are Islamists. And these were prominent liberals and prominent people. And then one Sweden Democrat stopped writing about how awful Muslims are having it when there's dying Norwegians lying on the street. And immediately the attention switched over to his tweet because he was sort of suggesting, it was not clear exactly what was wrong with it, but it was, they knew that it was something Islamophobic. But what he was saying was basically what we are saying now, that it's a shift in focus that immediately takes place. And this is this has been the case after the attack during 7th of October. Because what I've done, my wife thinks that I'm maniacal when I've done this, but I've gone back and I looked at each and every account of the signatories of the appeal to track back how did they react then. When we knew that a massacre had taken place, what did they write? What did they post? And what you find is that most of the signatories did not write anything. And a lot of our prominent writers in the culture sections and at the biggest papers and authors and politicians and also Muslim like imams that are often on the payroll of municipalities for peace projects or like dialogue between religions. How did they react? They reacted. Many of them reacted with joy, and it's always liking insane tweets. And some responded just like we were talking about, like saying, "Oh, this will be even worse for people in Gaza." And of course, they were right. But if that is your response to that immediately, then you're saying something about yourself. And I would say that the 7th of October is like a flare rocket going up. And all of a sudden, it's visible where everybody is standing. And it's been sort of dusk or dark, so you haven't been able to really, really see everybody. And all of a sudden, you see where everybody's standing. So, oh, you're standing over there. You think the most important thing right now is to discuss if it's 10 or 40 babies that's been had their head chopped off. Oh, you're standing over there. You immediately believed Hamas propaganda, the only source that Israel had bombed a hospital. That's what you believe. And you still do it. And so I think this is a very good opportunity to see their moral compass and where they are standing in regards to Jews, Islamism, and what they are ready to condone in the name of what they term justice.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my book. It's called A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable, and I've really been blown away by the response to it from readers, reviewers, Spike supporters. People really like this book, and I think you're going to like it too. It covers all the insanities of our time, from climate change hysteria through to COVID authoritarianism, through to the trans ideology, and it basically makes the case for more freedom of speech, more debate, and more heretical thinking to challenge the conformism of our times. So what are you waiting for? Go to Amazon right now and order my book, A Heretic's Manifesto, Essays on the Unsayable. And now on with the show.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the past 2 or 3 weeks have been the most revealing moment in Western politics for a very, very long time. In terms of, as you say, a flare has gone up and we can see things more clearly now in terms of where people are and how horrible where they are really is. You know, the kind of the veil has been ripped aside and we can see the ugly face behind so-called social justice or wokeness or whatever else it might be. Particularly on Sweden then, I did want to ask you about the Quran burning stuff, because that is quite well known around the world. And that's one of the reasons you mentioned earlier that Sweden is kind of being bullied at the moment by lots of Muslim majority countries, certainly by the leaders of those countries. A lot of that comes down to the fact that Sweden and also Denmark have had some Quran burnings in public. Last time I was in Sweden in July this year, there was one when I was there outside the parliament, I think, in Stockholm. And I want to ask you what the atmosphere is like now in relation to something like the Quran burning. So is there a suggestion that the attack in Brussels on Swedish citizens might be a consequence of Swedish disrespect for the Quran, as some people would see it? Are people starting to wake up to the fact that, you know, freedom of speech in Sweden for Swedish people, all Swedish people, is rather more important than the sensitivities of Erdogan in Turkey or the leaders of Iran or the leaders of Pakistan? How are people understanding that kind of global battle that Sweden has found itself in almost accidentally?
There are many people in Sweden, they think that it's wrong to burn the Quran and that it's wrong to just insult the religion. And it's not nice to do that. So why would you do that? And I think it is sort of, if you just take that part and you ask people about it, then I would say it's the majority opinion is that you should not be able to burn the Quran like that. It's awful. But what I've seen is that the people in the public sphere, people writing in the papers and journalists and academics, many of them are waking up to the fact that they were wrong. So people have been admitting that they have had the wrong position in public. And it's an ongoing development, but it's visible. So there's two trends, really. And I mean, I'm not saying that all sports journalists are stupid, because it's not true. But some of them are at least not, they're not well-versed in the complexities of these issues or why freedom of speech is important. So, like, this was a moment where soccer and politics and religion mixed in a weird way. So you had sports journalists feeling that they had to write something, and they wrote some really, really stupid things, some of them, where they just, okay, now it's taking its toll on soccer fans. Now it's time to stop this freedom of speech thing. So, but I'm not sure if they will return to the subject and if that made any dent in anything, but it was, you sort of felt like you wanted to take a ball and just kick it very hard in their face, like, shut up and don't write about this ever again. But mixed behind all this for us in Sweden is the fact that we used to be number one when it came to exporting music with ABBA, and now we're number one when it comes to exporting violent criminals. And we are outside of Mexico, we have the largest amount of bombings and grenade violence in a peacetime country. And people are there, the criminal gangs and the clans. The most spectacular thing is, of course, the shootings, the killings, and the death patrols, and the contract killers that are often kids themselves, and the grenades and the bombings, and that they're going after relatives. So they're no holds barred. People that are like cousin of a criminal has to flee. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. The criminal clans in Sweden has a, how do you say, their annual income is around 50% of the Swedish state budget. So it's 10% of the GDP that the criminal clans in Sweden are really. And we are also becoming one of the main transit countries for cocaine. So this is like, this was the debate the days before Hamas massacre and then the terrorist attack. So there's a shift in mood in Sweden that I would say that even, so I have friends I've known my whole life, or one of them, he canceled his membership in the old Communist Party, the left-wing party, because they were not communist enough, and he was very disappointed. And I have friends who's been in ship to Gaza, it's been organizers within the Palestinian cause, and they are shifting, and they've shifted. Like, so you can see that many have realized we are not that country that we used to be, and if we don't do anything about it now, it might be too late.
I did want to talk to you about what is happening with Sweden, actually. That is something I find very, very interesting. I've been to Sweden many times. I love Sweden. I've got lots of Swedish friends. I think it's a great country, even now. I think it's a great country, but lots of strange and curious and bad things are happening there. And we just have to be very honest about that. And I want to start off by asking you, you've mentioned it already, and we're all thinking about it all the time, which is the atrocity of the 7th of October in Israel and the fallout from that, not only in the Middle East, but around the world. And one of the elements of the fallout have been some pretty shocking demonstrations in America, in Britain, in Sweden, where people have either outright expressed support for Hamas or certainly got very close to doing so. We've seen religious extremists on the streets of London calling for jihad against the Jewish state, chanting Allahu Akbar in Trafalgar Square. And as I pointed out in a piece I wrote, those will have been the last words that many of those families in Israel heard before they were burnt alive or shot to death or whatever else might have happened to them. But that probably the most disturbing thing I've seen was from Sweden. I'm pretty sure it was in Stockholm. There was a large demonstration, pro-Palestinian, in quote marks, really these are all just anti-Israel, at which people were chanting, no Zionists in our streets. To me, that was incredibly chilling because you don't need a PhD in semantics and language to know what was being said there. It was essentially, we don't want the Jews here. That's what people are saying when they're saying no Zionists in our streets. You know, Sweden is not a Zionist country. It is not governed by Zionist nationalism. So when people are saying no Zionists in our streets, it's pretty clear what they mean, isn't it? And that's quite chilling, I think.
From the ocean to the sea, Palestine will be free. I mean, it's where's Israel in that equation? Couldn't see it there from the river to the sea. I mean, it's the strange thing is that many of the people who have been warning that the 30s are here again, and like they're meaning, of course, the German 30s. And now this is how the 30s began. This is how the 30s began. Many of them are nowhere to be seen. They are not writing about this. And the response has been very muffled or strained or nothing at all. And because, of course, they have their lesson, what they took away from Never Again was a majority must never be too critical or targeting a minority. So the lesson they took away was that if it's a minority doing this chanting and standing for anti-Semitism, their hands are tied behind their backs, really. But of course, what many Jews took away from Never Again is that they didn't want to be massacred or the victim of a genocide again. So there's two different ways, and much of the left is on the we have to have intersectional analysis. That was basically the takeaway from the Holocaust for them. And for many of us, basically on the right or the or many Jewish people, they just feel like it should be okay to be Jewish and walk around in the streets of Sweden. And the sad truth is that you can't, or you take a huge risk. And which is led by an imam and his wife and a few others. And they had like a cooperation together with the Jewish organizations there. And of course, the papers loved it and everything. And it's, I mean, if it would have worked, it would have been great. But now they've made such atrocious remarks in regards to the massacre at 7th of October and like put up pictures like if it's a Jew and a Muslim hugging and like a crossover, like you cannot put up this. And these are the people who led their project with, of course, with tax money. And so the Jewish organizations have withdrawn from the project now. I think this is the main problem here is that the left and not just the left, but the whole of society feels that it can't really criticize. It can't do something about it. I was at the newly opened Holocaust Museum in Stockholm, where I interviewed Jonathan Friedland, who wrote a great book called The Escape Artist about Rudolf Werba, who escaped Auschwitz, one out of maybe five Jews who escaped Auschwitz, out of a total of five. And he was the one who warned the world about the extent of the extermination of Jews and the machine. And saved lives of hundreds of thousands of Hungarian Jews. But in any case, that's what we can do. We have like Holocaust museums. We have remembrances, everything. But if it's not a neo-Nazi, and if it's not from the majority population, then like the answer is we don't have any answers. Then so you can pour how much money you want into a Holocaust museum. But if you can't keep Jews, actual living Jews, safe on the streets in Sweden, then what the hell are we doing?
Yeah, that's very well put. And I really agree with your point about, you know, they use the specter of the 1930s all the time, you know, the left and so-called progressives in political discussion. And it's almost like to them, everything looks like the Holocaust, except the worst attack on Jews since the Holocaust. Then you can't talk about the Holocaust. You can't talk about the 1930s. And in fact, in the week that we're speaking, The Guardian has published a piece saying the way in which Israel is talking about the 7th of October is an example of Holocaust exploitation. So there's this piece accusing Israelis of using the language of the Holocaust, for example, by saying that the 7th of October was the worst attack since the Holocaust, which it was. That's now being branded as Holocaust exploitation. And this is a newspaper, The Guardian, which has compared the vote for Brexit to 1930s Europe, which compared Trump to Hitler, which said that Islamophobia is a new form of fascism. And something really, I think, profoundly sinister and troubling is happening, which is that the Holocaust is being liberated from the Jews. So it's no longer their thing. It's no longer their experience. It's no longer a part of their history and, of course, human history. Instead, it's been co-opted by the kind of influencers and the agenda setters and the so-called left. It's been co-opted by them as an abstract tool that they can use to make their political points, to demonize certain political opponents and so on. So there's this separation taking place. And I think we're seeing it quite explicitly over the past 2 weeks between Jewish people and the Holocaust, and this kind of dismantling of Jewish people's position in history as the people who suffered under the worst crime in history, and the kind of chipping away at that by people in the West. And I worry about the consequences of something like that, where the word the 1930s, Holocaust, fascism are thrown around all the time. And yet when this happens, which to me is a bit like fascism, very much so, in fact, Hamas's attack on the Jewish civilians, they look the other way, or they say it's a day of celebration, or they call it resistance. I mean, that's really messed up, isn't it?
One of my closest friends is a Jewish Swede, Adam Sveiman. He's the political editor at Göteborgs Posten. It's the largest daily newspaper in Gothenburg. And he's read a lot of the Holocaust. His family's history is steeped in it. I mean, it's that's the reason he's in Sweden. But one of the things he told me when we spoke about this was that on the Eastern Front, when they committed the mass murders of Jews in those areas, and because they couldn't put them on trains to Auschwitz, the people perpetrating it, some of them went crazy. Many of them had to be drunk. They had to be forced. Some deserted and were shot themselves. I mean, I'm not saying this happened with everyone, but many of the Nazis perpetrating the crimes were unhappy with doing it. They were not the diehard ideologues of the SS, perhaps. But what was so chilling with the attack on 7th of October, which is something that I think is hard to fathom, is how glad people were and celebratory. And one of the killers called his dad from a phone that he had stolen from one of his victims, and he bragged and he said, "Father, I've killed 10 Jews. Be proud of me, father." And if it was a spontaneous act of desecration of dead bodies when they were parading the dead bodies around in the streets. And I think that what part of the Holocaust was that it was a part of denial. They knew, many of the people who lived close by. Now we know, and we knew back then, but they knew what was happening. And yet they didn't do anything or anything, but they tried to deny it. There was a part of denial. And so this is, I mean, I'm not saying that this is worse than the Holocaust, because of course it's a unique event and the scale of it is much, much larger. But there's a sinister quality when it comes to Islamic terrorism and Islamism that I, like, the mind almost is reeling to, like, can it really be this sinister, the level of it? And I'm sometimes I think that many of the left have a hard time. It's harder for them because these are the oppressed. These are the wretched of the earth. These are the subaltern rising. And then to take in the level of evil that they commit, that they are not the saints, they are not the freedom fighters. It might cause havoc to you the whole way you see, or your whole worldview. So it's harder for them. So they label Hamas right wing, for example. It's a common phrase. It's a right wing. They are conservative. Yeah, I want to see Roger Scruton, what he would have said about that. I mean, it's so strange how they try to apply those things. And but I think it threatens the left's worldview more to a degree.
Yeah, it's extraordinary what you say there about the glee that some of the Hamas terrorists seemed to take when they were carrying out their massacre. It was really extraordinary. And what was remarkable was that they wore GoPro cameras, they filmed it, they put some of the scenes up on Telegram. As you say, they boasted on WhatsApp, and they boasted to their parents about how many Jews they'd killed. I mean, there was none of the denialism or the sneakiness of the Nazi regime. I think you're right. You know, these are very, very different events, although both have their founding origin in Jew hatred, but they're very different events. But it's striking that, you know, the denialism that the Nazis engaged in, trying to hide the truth of what they were doing, was not visible here. Instead, what we had here was celebration and pride in the fact that they were killing Jewish people, and makes it so, so twisted and concerning. I want to ask you about another response in Sweden to that horrific event. You mentioned already the I think it was celebrities and writers and an assortment of people who wrote a letter, signed a petition about Israel and Gaza. I want to ask you what they said and also what they didn't say. I mean, we have a group here called in the UK called Artists for Palestine, who wrote an extraordinary letter that they all signed. Very, very well-known actors and writers and people signed it. It doesn't mention the word Hamas. It clears its throat by saying, we're sorry about victims on both sides, but it's all about what Israel does. It's all about Israel's so-called genocide. nothing about the act of genuinely genocidal terrorism, i.e. terrorism motivated by a desire to wipe out people on the basis of their race, doesn't mention it, glosses over it, moves on as quickly as you like from that, as if it's something they either don't want to contemplate or they can't contemplate. Was the letter in Sweden similar? Was there an avoidance of the truth of what's happening there?
It sounds very similar. And I think there are, it might even be that the Swedish letter is a knockoff from the English, as so much in Sweden is knockoffs of things from the USA or Britain, but they don't mention that. And as I said, I looked through what these artists, soccer players, and authors had written previously, and none of them had written anything of the massacre. So it didn't even exist. What happened, I think, was that when the massacre occurred, it was sort of like the Berlin Wall coming down, in a sense, in that it's a shock to the, if you're invested in the narrative of Israel being an imperialist state, crusader state, or a colonialist, and it's they are occupiers, oppressors, and then you see this atrocity, it's very hard to maintain that narrative. And then came the hospital bombing, or the alleged hospital bombing, and 500 people were dead, so it was said. And Israel had done that. And it's very human then to think, like, of course it was awful, people thought, but it's also a relief, because now you can maintain your narrative. So people jumped at it. And that was when the appeals started to come because of that, the hospital bombing, which turned out to be a propaganda piece from Hamas. And the rocket, as it seems, came from Islamic Jihad. So because, of course, they are using substandard rockets, because they are using materials that are should be put to better use for weapons, and they're building bad rockets. So that's why they made these appeals, and they didn't care. And then it's just, what is the safest possible way to say, end the suffering of the world? That's the best. World peace now, that's also good. But then, stop. The children haven't done anything in Gaza. And of course, that's true. But when you enter, if you concern yourself only with looking beautiful, sexy, making good music, or kicking a ball around, that's fine. It's fine. It's not fine. I'm not fine with the way our culture is, but let's say it's fine. But when you enter the political world, you are obliged to know the issue. And if you don't, you're dangerous. You're using your clout from another world, and you're using it, and you're making the world worse. It's not innocent. It's not empathetic. It's not compassionate. You're being used for a propaganda machine, and you're too stupid, or too ignorant, or too uninterested to even care. And that was what happened here in Sweden. And so, I mean, some people know precisely what they're doing, but many of them don't. But that's not an excuse.
If you're a regular listener to this show, or a regular reader of Spiked, why not become a Spiked supporter? Spiked supporters is our thriving community of people who donate to Spiked. Anyone who gives £5 or more a month, or £50 or more a year, can become a Spiked supporter and get access to lots of exciting perks. Spiked supporters can comment on articles, get free and discounted tickets to events, get a discount on all items in our shop, and bookmark articles as you browse. This is our way of saying thank you to all of you who fund our work. Spiked is completely free, and yet you still hand over your hard-earned cash to make sure that anyone, anywhere, can read us and listen to us. We're incredibly grateful for your generosity. If you don't give to Spiked yet, now is the perfect time to start. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to set up your donation and your Spiked supporters account. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.
Absolutely. I want to ask you about identity politics and identity politics in Sweden, because it's not something I know much about. In the Swedish context. My understanding is that Sweden has traditionally been a homogenous country. It worked on that basis that, you know, it was a pretty well-contained country with a world-famous welfare state or a system of government assistance, consensus politics, and so on. But I think, I know things have changed quite a lot over the past 5 or 10 years, maybe longer. But one of the things that struck me since the 7th of October, but I've been thinking about it for longer than that, is the way in which identity politics has rehabilitated not only racial thinking more broadly, but anti-Semitism specifically. Because as you were saying earlier, you know, they look upon a conflict like the one in the Middle East as the wretched of the earth versus the imperial aggressor. They manifest their obsession with privileged and oppressed onto every issue. You know, you're either in this box, you're oppressed and therefore you're good and you deserve our sympathy and our support, or you're in this box, you're privileged and you deserve hatred and contempt. Now, of course, they say that in relation to the Middle East, and they've been saying it there for many years, but they say it in relation to domestic events at home as well. You know, Muslims are oppressed, trans people are oppressed, and so on. But white men, heterosexual, Jewish, you know, the hyper-privileged ones in our society, the Jews, you know, they're problematic. So they rehabilitate an anti-Semitic atmosphere. I wonder if you think there has been, alongside the rise, the problematic rise of radical Islam in Sweden and other European countries, have identity politics contributed to this new racism as well, especially to the return of anti-Semitism?
Yes, but I would say that it's if your worldview consists of the seven ways to be discriminatory in according to the discrimination laws that were enacted in 2009 in Sweden, I think it's 2010 in Britain, but they have had similar consequences. It's very hard to combat the existing anti-Semitism, because and this is a way, like if you go on a ground level, many teachers are saying and are bowing down to the demands of their students that why are the Jews so special, why is the Holocaust so special, why don't you talk about the genocide being perpetrated against the Palestinians, the Nakba in 1948? And many teachers have no answer. And some of the answer is maybe we should update. There's been a debate. We should update how we talk about these things and be more, integrate the concerns of our new constituents, our new citizens. And I think instead, I mean, you should double down, of course. If you're going to be integrated into the Swedish society, you have to be integrated into the way we talk about history and the lessons. I mean, of course, there are things that you should learn about other people's traumas and everything, but the way it's been used, identity politics been used, is basically to delegitimize the Jewish history and the teaching of the Holocaust. And as you said earlier, they've sort of reevaluated the Holocaust in a totally different way. So it's the Holocaust is about all the minorities. And then you have the Jews being sort of a privileged minority, and they are white adjacent or white passing. There was and that's often like an accusation. It's a strange accusation, but it's an accusation often being leveled against the Jewish people. I mean, one thing that I find a little bit hopeful in Sweden is that, and different, is that I haven't seen any post-colonial, post-structuralist, post-modernist, anti-racist, Black Lives Matter enthusiast winning a public debate since basically 2013 in Sweden. And multiculturalists have gone to the same. I mean, these people are never winning. They are constantly losing. Every time they step into the public sphere, they are losing. They're losing in Swedish Twitter, they're losing in social media, they're losing in the mainstream media, in the politics, but they are very strong still within the governmental agencies, and they are like zombies. I mean, and you have these people, and this is a sort of a connection, because these people are running things at the university. They are, their theories are how the discrimination laws are being enforced at universities, in the governmental agencies, and even in businesses. And they are also, if you look at their social media accounts during the 7th of October, they are celebrating the massacre. And these are the people who are teaching teachers and social workers and police officers and academics about human rights and discrimination, and yet they are celebrating a massacre. So it's a very strange way, because if you would look at the in the public sphere, in the public debate, they are nowhere to be seen, and they never step up to the plate. So and I think that's a little bit different if you compare it to the United States or Britain. That they our identity politics activists, they are losers and cowards, and they hide behind their paychecks from taxes.
Yes, zombie politics is a good way to describe these people, because they're not particularly popular with significant sections of the public anyway, and one always thinks one has beaten them in an argument and pushed them aside, and yet there they are, you know, traipsing through public life as always. It's very curious and interesting. I want to ask you about what's happening in Sweden in terms of crime and integration, some of the things you've mentioned already. And it's very interesting to me because, you know, your current Prime Minister, Ulf Kristersson, I'm sure I pronounced that terribly, and your former Prime Minister, the leader of the Social Democrats, who you've mentioned. What's interesting about both of those, I think, one coming from the centre-right, one coming from more of the left, is that both of them have raised concerns about the failure of integration in Sweden. So both of them have quite openly said, look, we have an issue in this country because we took in very significant numbers of migrants, especially during the migrant crisis of 2015, from Muslim countries, and we didn't integrate them at all, really. You know, didn't integrate them into the labor market, didn't integrate them into cultural values, didn't say to them, you know, listen up, you're in Sweden now, so this is what we think and this is how we behave. I mean, if anyone had said that, it's very possible they would be accused of racist assimilationist tactics, or some other kind of ridiculous accusation would be made. So in terms of that discussion, you know, Sweden was once seen by Guardianistas in particular as the dream country, the welfare state, a spotless, wonderful country. You know, columnists like Polly Toynbee at The Guardian were forever gushing over Sweden. They, you know, you got the impression that the entire British middle class would just have up sticks and moved to Sweden if they could. But it's changed a lot now. And even The Guardian has articles about the fact that outside of Mexico, Sweden has the most grenade and bomb attacks. The fact that shootings have gone through the roof, the fact that gang crime is rather out of control. How bad have things got there? And what is the discussion around it? Do people share the sentiment of the current PM and the former PM that, you know, integration has failed and we need to rethink what we're doing?
Yeah, and I mean, people have been saying that the integration has failed for a very long time. And what's changed, I think, is the hopelessness of it, because Swedes are irrelevant. Swedish culture is irrelevant in large swathes of Sweden. So the only thing that is relevant in those parts of Sweden is how can you get governmental aid, and what will the police do? And is there like a social worker or something like that? And except for that, you don't have any really relationship to Sweden, Swedish people, Swedish language. So in many areas, there are no native Swedish speakers. And it used to be that you come to an area which is run down or socially economically challenged, as we say in Sweden, it's a challenged area. It's challenged, not really specifying what they are challenged by, but it's challenged. And then you get a job and or education, and you move someplace else. But what's happened in Sweden the last two decades, and especially the last 10 years, is that you get stuck. So you have nowhere to go. And it's a combination of factors. But so we have a deepening of the segregation. And I would say that the integration is working fine in Sweden as well, because we have, I think, half or more than half of the doctors in Sweden are foreign-born and educated in another country. We have a lot of people from earlier migrant cohorts that are integrated fine, and they view themselves as Swedes, and they are viewed as Swedes as well. And something else. I mean, as I like my friend, Jewish, Swedish, he's both. I know a lot of people who have a background from former Yugoslavia or Greeks, Turks. They are viewed as, of course, you see that they have roots from somewhere else. But culturally, I mean, I would say that some of these sort of stereotypes of we are so tolerant and we take people in, some of it is true. It's just that the scale of it and the speed of it, no country could have integrated. And so the difference between what the left wing, when they are saying that integration hasn't worked, what they are really saying is that we should have had larger governmental programs. We should have had courses in Swedish, or maybe like oriented them in how we do here in Sweden, like the laws and everything. And what people more on the right are saying is that, yeah, that's good, that's fine with all these governmental programs and everything, but it wouldn't have made a difference if you have 160,000 coming in a year to a small country. It doesn't matter whatever you do. You don't have enough teachers, interpreters, and then you would have to force majority Swedes and earlier waves of migrants to stick around to sort of be the vehicle for integration. And of course, people don't. We move. People move away. I just spoke to one of the social worker, sort of a guardianist, I would say. Like he fits the bill with what he studied, what he's working with, like everything. And he just moved because of grenade violence. I mean, he has no problem with diversity, but he has kids. He doesn't want them to be blown up. So you have people moving out if they can. And then the people who are stuck, how are they going to integrate? Even if they are really willing and have the best of intentions, they're not going to learn Swedish. Their kids are not going to learn Swedish, and they're not going to become Swedish.
Yeah. It's interesting, intriguing, and worrying in many ways as well. I do see Sweden as a bit of a, I think it's clearer in Sweden in terms of what's at stake if a society doesn't know itself and understand itself and is not willing to define itself, whether that is to its own people or to newcomers or to migrant populations. A country that's not willing to say who it is and what it's for, I think is in trouble. We have a very similar situation in Britain, but I see it quite starkly in Sweden. You mentioned earlier Malmo, the city of Malmo, which is a really large city in Sweden. I think it's third after Stockholm and Gothenburg. It's the third largest city. And there are big problems there. One thing I read about a couple of years ago was that people were organizing kippah walks in Malmo. So people would wear a Jewish skullcap kippah and walk through the streets, Jews and non-Jews, in fact, to try and encourage confidence in the Jewish communities there, that it was possible to still be visibly Jewish, even though things were getting a bit unstable and a bit unpredictable. We've seen also in Sweden, there have essentially been Islamic riots. You know, there have been uprisings of Muslim youths, especially in response to the burnings of Qurans. And there have been very serious riots in recent years.
And they've been happy. I mean, some of them, it's fun. I mean, it's you can see some of them when they're trying to kill police. They're glad.
So, is it fair to say, looking at all that, is it fair to say that there you might be moving to a situation where there are two Swedens? So there will be places like Malmo, which might just be given over to people who haven't integrated into the Swedish way of life, or who you know, where the failure of integration, as you say, everyone's calling it, where that's more explicit. You know, Malmo might just become a place where it's known for that, whereas Stockholm might become, I don't know, more Swedish, might maintain or retain some of those kind of values and that culture. Is there kind of almost going to be an unspoken partition in the country between those communities where, as you say, Swedish is rarely spoken, Swedish values are not adhered to, and they have become almost like cut-off multicultural bubbles. Is that the divide you think that Sweden can look forward to, or it won't be the singular country that it's been for so long, but it will be this kind of slightly broken nation with different communities?
I think we have been there for a while, and you don't visit these areas if you don't have any very specific errand. So there's no mixing, and you go to different schools, and you live in different areas. And I do think that Malmö is also a majority-minority town, a city in Sweden. And if you look at the young population, it's up to 70% are either foreign-born or have parents who are foreign-born. So it's been much more rapid in Sweden than people said. If you would have said that, this is a projection I see, and you would have said like 30 years ago, people would just shaken their heads and said like, that's fear-mongering and sort of, you're sort of vaguely racist. I'm not sure in which way, but it seems very racist to even suggest that that's the level of change, the pace of the change. And when it comes to integration, we are succeeding when it comes to giving migrants work. It's just that they are succeeding. We also have a lot of challenges, but it's actually some of it has gone better than it used to. But it doesn't seem to change the radicalism of the Islamic community. This also has been increasing. So more work and more Islamism, and also more crime. So even while grades have been going up in certain areas which are having a lot of trouble, or more of the pupils are succeeding in school, they are still more willing to join gangs, and the criminal clans are. So it's not clear cut, and then we have the shadow economy, which is huge in Sweden, and you have people who are rarely spoken about. For example, the Russian and Russian speaking minority in Sweden, and just came out a book about that, and it's a very unknown story because they're not part of the clan warfare or the gang, so they're not as spectacular, but there's a lot of violence, and they're being used as slave labor, and this is something that we see in lots of Swedish society in the job work sector. And this is, I mean, the people who organized, for example, the Kippa walks, it's a good symbolic gesture, but the same people were at the same time arguing that we should open the borders totally. So they didn't acknowledge where the problem came from. So the same people that were wearing, some of them were walking and writing about it, they were willfully ignorant of the reasons behind the anti-Semitism. And they still are, some of them. And they haven't acknowledged how they contributed to the problem. And the same people who made the Swedish job market liberalized and privatized and made it very easy for companies to just do whatever and import people from across the world to do something that someone 500 meters from you can do just as easily. They've opened the gates to basically we are having slave labor or indentured servants doing a lot of the chores and works and jobs in Sweden. And that's sort of that's like the third Sweden, because these people are working. They're working around the clock, but they're not, nobody's trying to integrate them. Nobody's doing a thing for them, basically. So we are a country in need of we haven't uploaded the latest update to our, the way we should view ourselves, and people are getting hurt.
Yeah, I think it is good to hear that, you know, integration is working in some ways. As you say, there are significant numbers of foreign origin doctors, for example, people who are contributing to Swedish society. But then there have been, I think, some catastrophic failures in other ways as well. And there has been either an unwillingness or an inability to draw people into Swedish society, or maybe it's just an impossible task, given, as you say, the speed with which this new intake occurred. You know, as someone who comes from a part of London where everyone's parents were foreign born, including my own. I do know that it is possible to have communities that come from somewhere else, but can create a sense of belonging. And the question, I think, is how we do that in the 21st century, when so many of the cultural trends are dragging us away from being part of society and telling us to celebrate this, recognize that, validate this identity, and it becomes a very divisive spectacle. My last question for you, Ivar, is on troublemaking. We started off with this. You said it's fairly easy to be a troublemaker in Sweden. I assume you mean that Sweden is known as being a pretty conformist country. I've never really bought into that, but I think that's because all the Swedes I know are quite contrarian people. So whenever I go there, I just hear all these controversial opinions. So I've never seen the kind of the conformist nature of Swedish society. But on troublemaking, I mean, you are a troublemaker, and I mean that as a compliment. I think they troublemakers are essential these days. But also, there has been a pushback in other parts of Swedish society as well. There has even been flickers of populism in Sweden, which surprised everyone. You know, people never thought that populism would even make it to nice, quiet Sweden. You know, the Sweden Democrats, who are often referred to as far right, or, you know, just right wing, the Sweden Democrats have done well in recent elections. People are obviously tired of what's going on and are looking for an avenue or a way in which to register their tiredness, register the fact that they don't like what's happening. Do you foresee more of that happening? Do you foresee more of a kind of populist pushback against the establishment, like we've seen in Britain with Brexit, in Italy with Giorgia Meloni, or in America with the vote for Donald Trump? In various different ways, people have registered their displeasure with the technocratic elites. Do you think a similar dynamic will entrench itself further in Sweden?
Yes, and I think because of the pace, I mean, Sweden is one of the most heterogeneous countries now in all of the Western world. I think Austria, and it's up there with Britain and France, but it's like happened in 20 years instead of 70 years. And what you can see is that basically immigrants vote left and children of immigrants vote left in Sweden. And so the Social Democratic Party, their constituents are completely different now than it used to be. And people of ethnic Swedish origin or of European ancestry, I mean, immigrants from other parts of Europe, tend to vote right. So you also have sort of a divide, a new divide in Swedish politics. And that divide is very visible now. Politics is changing a lot in Sweden. You can go on, you can be elected in the municipality on the Palestine question. So if you're partaking in these demonstrations and you're showing that to your constituents, people are getting elected on those issues. And I think populism will increase a lot, but not just on the right, it's also on the left. And you had left-wing politicians partaking in spreading the propaganda that the Swedish state are kidnapping Muslim kids. They had Linda Snecker, who's the spokesperson for the left-wing party in parliament. So she's not a nobody. When she's talking to constituents in the challenged areas where lots of people are foreign-born, she's using those kinds of that kind of rhetoric. And you could say that's populism as well. And you can also see that the more agrarian parts of Sweden have turned from the old. We, of course, have a proportional electoral system, so we have more parties than you have. It used to be that the center party is the old Farmers Coalition Party, and it used to be huge because there were a lot of farmers, and now they've shrunken. But in the countryside, they used to be big, but now we can see that the Sweden Democrats has taken over that role. So you can see that all the cities are red, and then the rich suburbs, where there's a lot of people, they are blue. And if you go a little bit further out, they vote for the Sweden Democrats. That's the largest party. So that's also a dynamic, that the people who are sort of in the Swedish rust belt, so to speak, where the industries have left, they're voting for the Sweden Democrats to a much larger degree now. And you could just, between the latest election and the election before, it's very visible that this is a new dimension in Swedish politics.
Ivar, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.